Thank you for your life and your death and your resurrection. We thank you for the example you set for us in how to handle trials and temptation. We thank you for your victory over every scheme of the enemy and over every plot of man. And God, help us to be like you. Help us to remember all that you've done for us. And God, we ask that today you would encourage and inspire each one of us to live this life for your glory. In your name we pray. Amen. All right. Well, we got a lot of regulars here today, so I'm just going to jump right into it. We have one guest from California. Amanda's here. Welcome, Amanda. So this is week 31, did you say? Greg, week 31, or is it 32? 32. So we'll finish with 33. That's good. So I'm just going to go straight to Matthew 27, verse 11. We've just gone through everything powerful and important. And Jesus has been turned over by Judas for cash, money, 30 pieces of silver. And now he's been brought to trial before Pilate. And it's a trial, but in a sense, it's really more of a hearing. It's not really following any of the official rules, but when they would have a trial like this, generally it would be in front of the palace and out on a platform, and then the whole crowd would gather around and they would go through. It's like a public hearing. Now we have them like the Kavanaugh hearings. It's public if you can get into the room, but there's so few people that are able to get in there because everybody and their brother is somehow on some committee or something. But we have it televised and we can watch it. In their day, it would just happen out in front and everyone would gather around and see what was going on. So we start out in verse 11. Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor questioned him, saying, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And Jesus said to him, "It is as you say." And while he was being accused by the chief priests and the elders, he did not answer. And then Pilate said to him, "Do you not hear how many things they testify against you?" And he did not answer him with regard to even a single charge. So the governor was quite amazed. And so Jesus, in front of Pilate, there's really one charge. There's only one charge that's official. There's only one charge that he needs to answer. According to the trial, Pilate has him up there for the charge of insurrection, that rebellion, that he is trying to cause commotion in the city, that he's, establishing himself as some new king that might go against Pilate and his authority. And so for that charge, he says, are you the king of the Jews? And Jesus uses the standard kind of non-answer that he's been using. He said it with Judas earlier. He said it with the mob in front of him. And he's like, "Well, you say so." Yeah. Basically, yeah. "It's as you say. I'm the king of the Jews." Now, John gives a little bit more of an answer here and gives a little more detail. Matthew, and you're going to see it especially in this passage today, that we're talking about some big themes that we've all heard over and over the years. And instead of me going into every one of the Mark, Luke, and John parallel passages, I want to kind of stay more close to Matthew because he has a point he's trying to make. There's a theme that he's on. And I think we started with this right from the first chapter, is he's writing this book to show that there's a new kingdom, there's a new covenant, and in that kingdom, there's a new king. And that king is Jesus. And so he's not trying to give every detail that it's ever happened in the world, but he's been on that main focus. And here it is, he sets it up, and in this today's chapter, he uses a governor like Pilate. He uses Pilate's pagan wife. He uses centurions. And all of them are used by Matthew to say the same thing. This is the king of the Jews. This is the Son of God. This is the one that we've been waiting for all of our lives. John wrote this in John 18:33. He says this story. Pilate entered into the praetorium, summoned Jesus and said to him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus answered, "Are you saying this on your own initiative, or did others tell you about me?" Pilate answered, "I'm not a Jew, am I? Your own nation and the chief priests delivered you to me. What have you done?" And Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would be fighting so that I would not be handed over to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not of this realm." Therefore Pilate said to him, "So you are a king?" And Jesus answered, "You say correctly that I am a king. For this I have been born, and for this I have come into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." And so there's a lot more detail in different passages when you read it, but Matthew's just keeping it clean, simple. Here's the facts. Are you the king of the Jews? Yep. Just like you said, yeah. He's not going to explain it. Yes, I'm the king of the Jews. So, as he announces that, you can hear in the background, and Matthew makes it clear, Pilate's got this one thing he's asking him, but in the background, the chief priests, and they're shouting out a bunch of stuff. You know, "No, and he did this too, and he did that, he's done a lot of bad, he's just bad. He's bad in every way." Because it says, while he was being accused by the chief priests and elders, he did not answer. They're bringing up a lot of other things. And then Pilate even says, "Don't you hear how many things they testify against you?" But Jesus doesn't answer any of those charges. None of them are relevant. He's not being tried by the Jews. So it's not relevant that he answers anything they're saying. He just lets it go. It's just chatter. But he does answer Pilate. Now Pilate, as we're going to see, goes, "Well, you're innocent. You haven't done anything." And so he knows it. But the Jews are just hurling all kinds of accusations against him. Pilate's only looking at whether there's an insurrection being planned or plotted by Jesus, and clearly there's not. And so, as far as he's concerned, there's no crime that's been committed. But imagine how tough that must have been for Jesus. To be falsely accused by all these people yelling all these things at you, and he just stayed quiet. That is tough. That has been one of the biggest struggles for me over the years. I've taken a lot of abuse over the years. Sometimes from friends and church members, sometimes community people, like, "Oh my gosh, he speaks in tongues. Oh, he casts out demons. Oh, did you hear he healed the sick?" You know, I mean, I've been yelled at by people for getting them healed. I mean, it's just ridiculous. You know, I've told this story, but I just think, I was ministering at a high school group in Watertown, and a girl was complaining about how she had a slipped disc or major pain. She was about to go in and get a spinal tap. So I had her sit down. Her leg grew out a couple inches. I prayed for her back. All the pain was gone. The disc went back in place. I mean, she was just jumping and celebrating, totally healed. And then she got on the bus to go back to school and started telling the bus driver. And the bus driver's like, "Nobody heals anymore. Someone did demonic, occult things to you." And she's like, "Oh my gosh, you're right." And so just like that, then I'm getting calls from people. "What demonic thing did you do?" I'm like, prayed for her? Well, that's just a little thing. There's been hundreds of those. And in the past, I tend to have a quick response. I'm pretty quick-witted. I've shared over the years that I used to be a little bit more sarcastic as a young man, a little more critical. This has been a prayer of mine all my life. "Lord, help me hold my tongue. Help me to hold back. Help me to not say what I already know." You know, because a lot of times I know things. My wife will let you know. I just know. I know what people are thinking. It's just something God, discernment that's given me. A lot of times I know what's in people's minds and in their hearts, and things are going on. I just kind of know a lot. And I have to choose to, like, just zip it. Don't cause any more trouble. I read Proverbs every day, and There's a lot of great proverbs about zip it. Zip it's the modern in the message. But one that I like is Proverbs 10:19, where there are many words, transgression is unavoidable, but he who restrains his lips is wise. And Jesus was wise. He could have just got into a big row and a debate, and he would have won, except for fools don't care about wisdom. And that's one of the things you learn over the years, is that most of the arguments you have are with people that aren't looking for actually answers. And so those are going to be useless. If Jesus would have started debating the Jews, it wouldn't have mattered. It would have ended up with them going, good points, crucify him. Because they weren't really wanting true wisdom. Fools just want to throw their opinion out and just debate for no reason. And the sooner you learn how to zip it in those situations, the less hassles you'll have in life. You know, you got to discern. Some people you go, you don't really care what the real truth is, so I got nothing to say. And that's tough to walk away from. Right? I mean, that's tough. Yeah, only an emoji maybe could cover it. But I'm learning, and Jesus was way ahead of the game. He knew how to zip it. Well, let's keep going. I don't know if there's a little side light there, but verse 15. Now, at the feast, the governor was accustomed to release for the people any one prisoner whom they wanted. The scholars have searched forever, and they have found no Roman or Jewish law that would back that up. And so the thinking then is that this would be a local festival rule. Kind of like a local city might say, every year we bring out the groundhog, and then if he sees his shadow, it's 6 weeks. If he doesn't, it's 6 weeks, and it's all the same, but we do it. It's a big festival. It's amazing. And that was kind of like probably a local thing. Maybe it was something that Pontius Pilate was doing, kind of like every president pardons certain people at the end of their term. It's just been out of control in my lifetime. The last week of a presidency, it's just pardon, 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 pardon. And people that are pardoned throughout the term are usually actually people falsely convicted. People pardoned the last couple days are those that are big donors to that political party usually. But this was like his way of saying, hey, I'm a great guy, right? Who do you want me to set free? There's something really cool here. Let's finish these next few verses, and I want to explain this. Verse 16, at that time, they were holding a notorious prisoner, B-I-G. The notorious Barabbas. So when the people gathered together, Pilate said to them, whom do you want me to release for you, Barabbas or Jesus, who is called Christ? For he knew that because of envy, they had handed him over. Just an interesting fact that I've uncovered over time here is that Barabbas' name, full name, is actually Jesus Barabbas. Many manuscripts, original manuscripts, say Jesus Barabbas. Some don't say Jesus Barabbas. And so the scholars will tell you, no translator was sneaking in Jesus Barabbas. There obviously were people erasing Jesus Barabbas because they didn't want Jesus to be associated with Barabbas. But if you see that in there, it starts to make sense why he has to describe Jesus as the Christ. So it'd be more like, which one of these Jesuses do you want me to release? The notorious Jesus Barabbas, or Jesus, who is called the Christ? And so just nuggets that I find interesting when you're studying the word, but which one of them do you want? Well, this is just like our political system, just where it's just so ridiculous, you can't even understand it. Like, who do you want? The candidate that says we should kill babies, or the candidate that says we should love babies? And our country is like, I'm not sure. And it's like, this kind of seems like the same to me, where it just doesn't make any sense. All my life, I still don't understand the dumb decisions made in voting and politics. But I can't start talking about it, or it will never end. Zip it. So the crowd, verse 19, the crowd is, they're mulling it over. You know, oh, well, who do we want? The savior of the world or the notorious rebel Barabbas? So while they're thinking about it, verse 19, Matthew tells what's been going on behind the scenes. While he was sitting on the judgment seat, Pilate's wife sent him a message saying, "Have nothing to do with that righteous man. For last night I suffered greatly in a dream because of him." Now, that's pretty awesome. I was meditating on that, thinking about how cool is that. This is just like what's going on right now in the Middle East, that Muslims and people all over are getting these dreams, and in their dreams, they're seeing Jesus. She had the same thing. She saw Jesus in her dreams, and she was so clear about it. She says, "Don't have anything to do with that righteous man." She understood, and Matthew's using her voice to again show the innocence of Jesus. Verse 20, "But the chief priests and the elders persuaded the crowds to ask for Barabbas and to put Jesus to death." Unbelievable. The chief priests and the elders. These would be the Al Sharpton and Jesse Jacksons of the Jewish people. You know, they had the voice, but no reason. And verse 21, "The governor said to them, 'Which of the two do you want me to release for you?' And they said, 'Barabbas.' Pilate said to them, 'Then what shall I do with Jesus, who is called Christ?' And they all said, 'Crucify him.'" Yeah, that's it. And Pilate gets it. His wife knew he was a righteous man. Pilate says, "Why? What evil has he done?" He's done this trial. It probably wasn't that thorough. It wasn't like a 2-year investigation. But he's like, he hasn't done anything. But they kept shouting all the more, saying, "Crucify him." Now, Pilate, as we know, is a man pleaser. And man pleasers have no convictions. They don't stand up for what's right or just. They only do what the crowd wants, whatever will give them more bonus points with the people around them. So verse 24, "When Pilate saw that he was accomplishing nothing, but rather that a riot was starting, he took water and washed his hands in front of the crowd, saying, 'I am innocent of this man's blood. See to that yourselves.'" Now, you can do that, and people do it in the movies. "I wash my hands of this. I'm not responsible." But guess what? You still are. Because he's the one that turns him over to be crucified. You can't say, "I'm not responsible. You wanted it." No, you don't get let off because you're a big man pleaser. He is still accountable and will be judged and was judged for what he's done. But the people respond again in a ridiculous way. And Matthew's shown this over and over through the scriptures, how they continue to call curses upon themselves. And verse 25, "The people said, 'His blood shall be on us and on our children.'" I mean, what? But I think that's what's going on even now. You read statements by people that are pro-abortion saying, you know, we literally love this, that people have the freedom to take their own child's lives. It's wonderful. We're for it. This is beautiful. This is what we've given our lives to. It's really not much different. It's just such a wicked, wicked, evil spirit. So then Pilate released Barabbas for them. But after having Jesus scourged, he handed him over to be crucified. Now, As I've been studying, going through Matthew and really thinking about this, because every time I'm trying to decide how much should I bring in from outside and how much should we just stick with what Matthew's saying, but realize that myself and probably most preachers, we really love to go into the details of every beating and whipping and bloodshed and et cetera, et cetera. And I mean, that's usually what you do at an altar call or Easter Sunday, man. You just give it to us, you know, give it the facts. But I notice Matthew doesn't do that, nor do any of the other gospel writers. Nobody gives much detail about how gruesome or how evil or how horrible it was. I think it was understood that if you get scourged by Romans, it was bad. Crucified. Do we really need graphic detail? Like he was nailed to wood and hung out to die. I think we get it. It's bad. But the point is that that isn't the emphasis. The main point isn't how horrible the torture was. The main point is what was being accomplished on the cross. What is he trying to show? That he is the king of the world. That he is the Son of God. Not that who can handle more torture. And then over the years you see celebrations around the world where people get crucified just to experience it. In the Philippines, every year they have this big ceremony and lots of people go out and they get nailed to the tree too so that they can suffer like Jesus. I think they generally rescue them from dying. But it's like, see, that's ridiculous. We have kind of, and I'm pleading a little guilty here to this too, but we have a fascination with this kind of stuff. Remember, I was thinking of how when the Challenger blew up over 30 years ago, it was like it went up and 74 seconds into the flight, it exploded, and then another minute later, it hit the water at 200 miles an hour, and everyone was killed. It was like they're dead. But people were so worried for years. You hear these conversations. Did they suffer? Well, yeah, they're dead. But what about that 1 minute? Could they breathe? Were they choking? Was there smoke? And it's like we kind of missed the whole big picture, I think. Did they suffer? Well, yeah. They're dead. And if they're saved, who cares? They're with Jesus right now. And if they're not saved, yeah, they are suffering. 1 minute of smoke inhalation won't compare to a billion years of it. It's a tangent. But the point is, yeah, Jesus was scourged. Josephus talks about it in light of another Jesus who was scourged. A lot of people were named Jesus. It wasn't a magical name. It's just common. Just kind of like now, every time I watch a Brewers game or anything where there's a lot of Hispanics, you know, there's always a Jesus will hit a home run or Jesus will steal third or make a diving catch. And I can't not think about it. And every time I'm like, way to go, Jesus. It's similar back then. It's a common name. But this Jesus, it said, when he was scourged, it says he was flayed to the bone. That was the common way. That literally they would be cut with rope, with the leather straps, with pieces of bone and metal at the ends of it. And they would be whipped 13 times by a three cords. And that would give you your 39 lashes and just literally flayed to the bone. Many people died during the scourging. So, without going too far on that, it's just like we know, this was a horrible, horrible thing. And it shows, like, Pilate's like, I think he's kind of innocent, but oh, we'll go ahead and crucify him. In the meantime, just flay him to the bone. So, he's not really this innocent character, is he? Verse 27, the governor's soldiers took Jesus into the praetorium, and they gathered the whole company of soldiers around him. A company battalion then would be about 600 people. So this is a huge company, and different commentators will have different numbers, but that seems to be pretty common. They stripped him, put a scarlet robe on him. That would be similar to the emperor would wear a purple robe. It was like a way of mocking him. And you see this whole passage, it really isn't so much the abuse he took physically, it's the mockery of Jesus is the point that they're making here. They stripped him. That in itself would be a major offense to a Jewish man. They put a scarlet robe on him. They twisted together a crown of thorns and set it on his head. Again, I was studying that. It's like generally a crown of thorns. The thorns would point up and away. That it wasn't that they stuck it into his head as much as you see in the pictures. It wasn't really that, oh, thorns are hurting me. He's about to be crucified. It's really more they just mocked him. They spit on him. They shouted, mocking him, "Hail, King of the Jews." They took the staff that they had given him and took it back and struck him on the head again and again. And after they had mocked him, they took off the robe, put his own clothes on him, and then they led him away to crucify him. It's really, I don't want to keep coming back to politics, but it's just amazing. I talked about this last week, the religious spirit. And how crazy and angry and ridiculous we can get when we're mad about a point of doctrine or something. And let's resist that, right? You know, let's be right in what we believe, but let's not be the angry right wing or whatever. Let's just be right and be confident that we know the truth. And then you gotta really fight to love people that are ridiculous. It's hard. Zip it. Verse 32, here's a guy that must have become quite a hero because as they were going out, they met a man from Cyrene named Simon and they forced him to carry the cross. Now, there's no reason for Matthew to give his name except honor. It's most people believe that he must have joined with them afterwards. That he became a disciple and that Matthew's like, Simon was the man. He carried, you know, that cross beam. It wasn't the whole cross. You would have just the one cross beam that they would be nailed to and then that would be hooked up with the supporting beam that would already be in the ground. But, they honor Simon and for all of time, this man is known as the man who carried the cross for Jesus. Pretty cool. They came to a place called Golgotha, which means the place of the skull. And there they offered Jesus wine to drink mixed with gall. But after tasting it, he refused to drink it. When they had crucified him, they divided up his clothes by casting lots. And sitting down, they kept watch over him there. And above his head, they placed the written charge against him. This is Jesus, the King of the Jews. I don't know if I'm just ornery today. I don't feel ornery, but I think it's just this passage got me in that kind of a mode. But there's a church that they built on the site called the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And it really is, to me, one of the most demonic places I've ever visited in my life. It's dark. It's evil, there's muttering and weird, it's just weird. Like I felt like I was going into a witch's coven when I went there and I didn't like it. And then a ways away from that, now they say that's the place where Jesus had been crucified and they built a church there. But then a ways away from it, there's the garden tomb. And that's one of the most peaceful, beautiful places I've ever been in all my life. So I'm thinking that's probably more accurate. When you're at that tomb, you can look up and there's a huge rock outcropping and it literally looks like a skull. And to me, that it seems like the perfect location and what they were talking about. And that's what the Christian church believes now, that was more likely the area where the crucifixion had taken place. But when you're in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, there's a stone there that supposedly Jesus had fallen upon, and people are down on the ground kissing it and, you know, just doing whatever. And you're like, it was just so weird. And there's guys wearing these robes muttering around and everything's covered in like an inch of ash. And it's just sick. I should just be more honest. But then you go to the garden tomb and it's just beautiful flowers and I mean, you just sense the presence of God. I mean, it's really is amazing. Right? It's just like a totally different feel. And so, couple things that I've seen over the years is I've heard preachers talk about, and I've mentioned it, but you know, they talk all about Jesus had a garment that was so expensive that there were no seams in it. And that's why the centurions cast lots for it. Normally they just split all the clothes up, but this one was so valuable that they cast lots. Only one would get it. And I've heard whole teachings about Jesus was a rich man with fine clothes, and that's why, you know, I wear $10,000 suits, and I think, wow, that in this passage, as we're talking about Jesus being nailed to a cross, what you came away with was that Jesus wore expensive clothes too. And I think that's the prosperity gospel where it gets really weird. Where we believe that God wants to bless us and prosper us. But when we start to justify selfishness, that's when we've gone too far, right? That's where it's a little bit ridiculous. And that isn't the heart of what we're looking at here. I think the reality is that this is a fulfillment of what we read in Psalm 22. Psalm 22:18, it said, it was prophesied, they divide my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. And I watched a video a couple days ago. A friend of mine from Africa posted it. And it's a pastor I've never heard of, so he's not even one of the big name pastors to me. But it's an African pastor that was on his way to come to a convention center, and he was in a caravan of Rolls Royces. And, like, not one, but a caravan of Rolls Royces. Now, if you know, they're like 400,000 plus, these kind of cars, and these ones were fancy. A caravan of them with 8 motorcycles all around him, protecting him, and then news reporters going off about that the man of God was about to arrive. And I mean, it was like God himself was about to show up. And that's where this wrong spirit can start to take us, where it's like we miss the entire point that Jesus gave his life. He laid his life down. He died on our behalf. Not like, and there was the opposite going on. He was rejected by his disciples, rejected by the entire crowd, rejected by the Jewish people. Even when they liked him still, he came in a baby donkey. And it's just really silly. We have to be careful, you know. I don't think we'd have never had the possibility of that even happening. But let's just not get caught up in all that hype. It's just ridiculous. Let's remember what the point of all this is, right? Verse 38. Two rebels were crucified with him, one on his right and one on his left. Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, "You who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. Come down from the cross if you are the Son of God." You remember who said that earlier? Satan. If you are the Son of God, you could turn these stones into bread. This is going back to like the Garden of Eden. Did God really say? And they're mocking and taunting Jesus. The chief priests and the teachers of the law and the elders mocked him. Their line was, "He saved others, but he can't save himself. He's the King of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross and we will believe in him." He trusts in God. Let God rescue him now if he wants him. For he said, I am the Son of God. And in the same way, the rebels who were crucified with him also heaped insults on him. Now we know from John, you know, that one of them wakes up halfway through. He starts to realize, hey, wait a second. But as of now, Matthew's making it clear, even the two rebels are mocking Jesus while they hang next to him. This was a common punishment for mostly violent criminals and those that had engaged in rebellion against the government. I mean, the death penalty is basically what crucifixion was. It was known as the most violent way you could end someone's life at the time, because you were nailed to a tree, you were hung out in the sun, and then you had already been beaten, so you had been scourged, so you're already losing blood, you're hanging there, and the key, and I've talked about this a lot, but is that you can't breathe when you're like this, so they would have to pull themselves up to get each exhale. So you would inhale, and then you'd come up to exhale, and that was the torture of just all day having to twist yourself up and down on those nails. But Matthew doesn't make a big deal of that. Instead, he comes right to this, in verse 45. From noon, which is the sixth hour, until 3 p.m, darkness came over all the land. All the astronomers and scholars, they love to study those kind of things. They said there was no eclipse that happened at that time. There was no astronomical reason. It was straight up God suffering. That God himself caused this darkness to come over the land. Just like he had with the children of Israel and Moses, and at times where this was definitely a specific thing that happened just over their area. And so just imagine, sheer darkness appears at noon, where everything goes dark until 3 o'clock. And I think that started to help wake up the man on the cross that ended up turning around. And we see the centurions. About 3 p.m, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, Eli, Eli, lima sabachthan, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? And he's quoting, again, like many, I didn't read all of them, but a lot of the lines in here come straight out of Psalm 22. Psalm 22:1 says, my God, why have you forsaken me? Far from my deliverance are the words of my groaning. And so even in the midst of his dying breath, Jesus is quoting the word. Matthew keeps coming back. I told you there's over 130 direct quotations from the Old Testament in Matthew. Here's another one of them. Jesus cries out. Now, God hasn't forsaken Jesus in that, you know, he has now been banished to hell or anything. But for that moment, we can only imagine, but that moment, he's taking on the sin of the world. And in that moment, probably there's a separation. There's, who knows how it's all happening on the cross. But it's a moment of intensity that no one cares to describe and explain everything that's going on. But at that moment, he's fulfilling what had been prophesied in Psalm 22:1. Verse 47, when some of those standing there heard this, they said, he's calling Elijah. I guess there's a mixture there of Eli, Eli is Hebrew, and then lima sabachthan is actually Aramaic. And so depending, it's kind of like a mixture. Eli would have meant in their local language, Elijah. And so they're thinking, oh, he's calling on Elijah. You know, we'd already seen throughout that Elijah was going to come and prepare the way. Maybe this is it. Maybe this is what's going to happen. But no, that's not what he was doing. And immediately, one of them ran and got a sponge. He filled it with wine vinegar, put it on a staff, and offered it to Jesus to drink. They say it's kind of like this mixture with gall and stuff would be almost like a sedative that you would offer someone to help dull the pain. But remember, I think Jesus had said, I'm not going to drink this again till I drink it with you in paradise. in my kingdom. And so when he tasted it, he realized what it was, and he didn't drink it. Verse 49, the rest said, leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to save him. And when Jesus had cried out it again in a loud voice, he gave up his spirit. I think it's John who says, it is finished. And verse 51, at that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook, the rocks split, and the tombs broke open. This is a pretty awesome scene. I hope Mel Gibson does it really well in the new movie he's working on. But the common idea is that obviously when the veil that separated the Holy of Holies with the rest of the temple was like a 3-inch thick theater curtain. Imagine like a theater curtain, you know, those ones that cover the screen or whatever, but this one's 3 inches thick. And so it hung there to keep everyone out. Only the high priest one day a year got to go in, right? Everybody else, you stay out of the Holy of Holies. And it's like at that moment, it's signified. It rips from the top. And he makes that clear. It was torn in two from top to bottom. Normally an earthquake, you maybe think you'd go the other way, but it was like God tore that thing open and said, you know, the Holy of Holies is open now for everyone. Everyone can approach. Everyone has access to God. The veil has been rent. There's no separation anymore. It's not just the high priest that gets to go in and be with me. All are welcome. The earth shook. The rocks split. So it's been dark for 3 hours, and then all of a sudden an earthquake hits. That had to be a total freak out. And then the tombs broke open. And the bodies of many holy people who had died were raised to life. They came out of the tombs after Jesus' resurrection, and they went into the holy city and appeared to many people. Now a lot of commentators will go, well, you know, such as, I don't know, probably this is metaphorical, but anyway, moving along. I love this. I think something cool happened. I don't know, you know. I mean, it's kind of like when Elijah was thrown into a grave, a robber that had been killed was thrown into the grave, and it happened to be where Elijah's bones were, and when he hit it, he came alive. I think there was probably, you know, a little power released at that moment, right? That, like, it was just like this charge, this blast that kind of people just came alive. I mean, I don't know, but I want to see that. That'll be one of those cool scenes. I'll be like, replay that one. Yeah, show that one again. I would go in the holodeck and see that. So they came out of the tombs and went into the holy city and appeared to many people. So we don't know who were they. How long did they stick around? Did they just join back into regular life? Or were they gone a couple days later? They died again? Or did they go back? You know, I don't know. It's crazed. I don't know. I love it. But I'm not sure. Were they all creepy like Thriller? Or did they just come out and become like cool? I don't know. I got no answers. Verse 54. Here's the climax of all of this. When the centurion and those with him who were guarding Jesus saw the earthquake and all that had happened, they were terrified and exclaimed, surely he was the Son of God. So all of this, Matthew's writing, he's sharing about how Pilate's like, what has he done? He doesn't seem guilty to me. His wife's like, this is a righteous man. He's like, are you the king of the Jews? You say I am. They're like, he says he's the king of Jews. Oh, he's the Son of God. If you're the Son of God, come down from the cross. Oh, if you're the king of the Jews, why don't you come down and just change it right now? You know, and all along we're seeing all these things, but it's been all building to this final moment. You know, I don't know. I can't remember which movie it was, but John Wayne says the line, in one of the Jesus movies, where John Wayne is the centurion, and he goes, "Surely this was the Son of God." And you're like, John Wayne, you're like, really? I'm not sure. But there, it was very dramatic that he wanted that line, that he wanted to be the centurion. But this is the climax. Surely he was the Son of God. Verse 55. Many women were there watching from a distance. The disciples had all scattered. They were gone. I mean, if this guy's being tried for insurrection, any one of his gang members would be also under suspicion, would also be facing persecution, right? And so the men are like cleared out. You weren't allowed to come around in that kind of a setting, but the women could get away with it. And so they're all there watching, and they had followed Jesus from Galilee to care for his needs. I'll talk more about them next week, but among them were Mary Magdalene. You see what an important part she plays. I shared about her last year how, I mean, she's mentioned first, then Mary, the mother of James and Joseph, and then the mother of Zebedee's sons. And so they're all watching from a distance. They've been following Jesus since Galilee. They're like probably widows or, heiresses that have a lot of money. They believe the message of Jesus. They've been traveling, not only providing funds for him, but cooking meals. And they were like support staff that have been caring for Jesus all along. And when he's at his lowest point, the women are still there, still watching, still ready to care for him. Verse 57, as evening approached, there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who had himself become a disciple of Jesus. Going to Pilate, he asked for Jesus' body, and Pilate ordered that it be given to him. You don't have access to Pilate if you're not a big shot, okay? You know, just random guy can't walk up to the governor, especially in this kind of a tense, you know, a riot kind of situation. You don't just walk up to Pilate and go, "Hey, man, I was just thinking." No. He obviously was a major donor, businessman, big shot. And so he has access to Pilate, and he comes up and he asks for the body. Otherwise, you know, those that were crucified, they would just be chucked into a common grave. Maybe a mass grave. They would just bury the bodies. There was no honor for someone that had been crucified. You didn't get to go into a tomb. You were just tossed into a mass grave, just like we see, whether it's how the Germans took care of the Jews or others throughout history where there's genocide. You're treated like garbage, like dung. But he asked for the body. And like we saw earlier, he was a disciple of Jesus, a rich man, and we find earlier in other passages that he was actually part of the Sanhedrin. He had some official Jewish status. And so Joseph took the body, verse 59, and wrapped it in a clean linen cloth and placed it in his own new tomb that he had cut out of the rock. He rolled a big stone in front of the entrance to the tomb and went away. Mary Magdalene and the other Mary were sitting there opposite the tomb. Most people had family tombs. So like you see, rich people now have mausoleums where there's like a little building, and then they'll have multiple bodies that will go in there. And what they would do in Jesus' time is you had a family tomb. You would have, like, if you've been to the garden tomb, it's like a two-room one that they believe might be the one, but otherwise it's very accurate of what it might be like. But you would leave the body for about a year and just let it decompose. And then a year later, you would come and collect the bones, put them in a little box, and then they would slide the box into the wall. Really not much different than what we do now. It's just they would have to carve it out, chisel out that slot, and then they would put the box in there. And so that's why they keep finding bodies that are in boxes. That's how you did it at that time. It was a way to conserve space and deal with it. Well, the family tomb, right in Jerusalem, that's That's a wealthy thing. That's a big deal. And this guy is a wealthy man. He's willing to give that kind of honor to Jesus. But notice, he's giving honor to Jesus as a dead man. Verse 62, Mary and Mary are sitting opposite the tomb, and now we get to Saturday. We're only up to Saturday of Passion Week. So for the last 10 weeks, basically, we've been covering 1 week of time. But now we begin with Saturday morning. You know, we used to call it Good Friday, Resurrection Sunday. We started saying Saturday was Silent Saturday. I mean, there's not much is going on. Jesus is just doing battle in the places we don't understand. Verse 62, the next day, the one after Preparation Day, the chief priests and the Pharisees went to Pilate. "Sir," they said, "we remember that while he was still alive, that deceiver said, 'After 3 days, I will rise again.' So give the order for the tomb to be made secure until the third day. Otherwise, his disciples may come and steal the body and tell the people that he has been raised from the dead. And this last deception will be worse than the first." "Take a guard," Pilate answered. "Go make the tomb as secure as you know how." So they went and made the tomb secure by putting a seal on the stone and posting the guard. I was thinking a few things there. These Jews were really good at remembering what Jesus had said. Right? I mean, all along, they're just kind of like, they're all so confused, but yet they remember everything that he said. The disciples don't even remember that. Right? I mean, the Jews are like, "He said he's going to rise from the dead. I know they're going to try to trick us. We better get a guard there and guard him. It's going to be on the third day." And the disciples are like, "Oh man, let's go fishing." They didn't remember what Jesus said. And if they did, they weren't trusting what he said. It seems like the Jews, they all along, you know that, they played dumb, but all along they knew what he was saying. They knew what was clearly being spoken to them, and yet they still denied it the entire time. And so Pilate, of course, sends the guard, and next week we'll get into that. We'll talk more about it. But they go guard the tomb, make it secure, and now we have a spot right there being guarded. And it's funny, there's books that have come out since, that have been written by people trying to show, even to this day, and I'll do that next week, but how the body was stolen, or the swoon theory is that Jesus never was really dead. He was just kind of passed out for a while, and then he came back to life, and after everything he had been through, he just quick pushed the stone out of the way, overpowered all the guards, and went out and lived happily ever after. It was all just a big con. But I think Matthew makes it really clear. He's in the tomb, but we know that there's Matthew 28 is coming. But just like the Passion of the Christ, we end there. And so next week we only have 20 verses and we finish up Matthew. And Jesus is going to rise from the dead. I'm just going to give you a little teaser up front. A little spoiler. I should have said spoiler alert, but yes. He rises from the dead, and then he gives us the Great Commission. And we'll wrap up Matthew next week. What a powerful, powerful book, right? I mean, so much is in there. And so I just want to say, let's not get hung up on all the graphic details of everything Jesus went through, or hung up on how fancy his robe was, or all these little things outside, and miss the main point. The main point is Jesus loved us so much that he was willing to come and live and be mocked and be beaten and give his life for us because of his love for us. And that in doing that, we can be rescued, we can be delivered, we can be forgiven. we can have the same life and live forever. And if guys can come out of tombs because of the surge of power, imagine what can happen in our lives if we let his power flood us, right? Well, I'm going to end and pray, but if anyone has a need today, if you need physical healing or you know, come up. We'll be up front here. I mean, we're always available. I know you all know this, but you know, take advantage of it. We'd be glad to pray for you. And God does still do miracles at times, you know? And why not get yours, right? Now let's pray. Lord, thank you for all that you did. Thank you for all that you're doing. That you are alive. That you defeated death. That you defeated hell. That you defeated the hosts of hell. That you are victorious. And that you are interceding for us 24/7, standing in the gap on our behalf. And God, I ask that today you would remind us, each one of us, what an awesome, awesome thing it is that you gave yourself for us. Help us to never doubt it. Help us to not get caught up in our own problems and our own silly things, knowing that you gave it all and that we can have that life that you promised and that you paid for on our behalf. And so, God, we ask that you would continue to help us walk into that Holy of Holies. Thank you for rending the curtain, for tearing it from top to bottom, for opening up the door that we can come boldly into the throne and receive mercy and grace in a time of need. And we ask, God, that we would remember and that we would walk in and receive from you. God, thank you for your grace. Thank you for your mercy. And thank you for Jesus. It's in his name we pray. Amen.